I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
So the Constitution has a provision. It's called Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And this provision says that anyone who took an oath to support the Constitution, but then broke that oath and engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the U.S. Constitution, or gave aid and comfort to its enemies, is forever disqualified from any public office unless and until two-thirds of both chambers of Congress vote to remove that disqualification.
Hi, friends. As I record this, Trump has just won the Iowa caucuses. You know, we don't talk horse race politics on this podcast, but as we talked about last week, Trump's candidacy faces challenges in state courts on his eligibility to be president under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, along with the four indictments and 90-some-odd felony counts against him. This week, I talked to Ron Fine, the legal director of Free Speech for People, about his groups and others' challenge to Trump's eligibility in various states. Free Speech for People began challenging Trump's eligibility to become president again in December 2021, and now several states are beginning to rule one way or the other on whether he can be on their ballot. On the day this episode comes out, January 17th, a trial court in Maine is set to issue a decision on that Secretary of State's ruling that Trump is ineligible for the ballot. And the U.S. Supreme Court has taken up the case from Colorado, where the Colorado State Supreme Court ruled Trump was indeed disqualified. In our conversation, Ron Fine goes into detail about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and why it applies to Trump without question. And it is not just legal organizations who are pursuing this argument. Serious legal scholars are talking about it too. Two conservative Federalist Society constitutional scholars, William Bode and Michael Stokes Paulson, wrote a Law Review article last summer in which they make the conservative case for disqualifying Trump from running for office. The media has also begun to talk about this issue, especially with it coming up before the U.S. Supreme Court. But as usual, we can't expect the mainstream media to treat it seriously and fairly. So take a listen here so that you can become knowledgeable on the issue from a firsthand participant. At the end of the conversation, Ron sets up a hypothetical situation where a particular candidate we all know and love would be disqualified to run based on the Constitution's provisions. I look forward to hearing what you think after this conversation. Please email me or respond on social media or Substack. You can also leave a voice message on the website www.freedomoverfascism.us. If you like this podcast, please support us and help us continue to talk to important and inspiring guests. There are a lot of ways to help: Patreon, the Freedom Over Fascism Substack, or via our website. Unlike many other podcasts, we don't have a staff, other than me, to work on research, engineering, or social media. Now, here's one of the most interesting conversations I've had since I started this podcast a year ago. Ron Fine, welcome to Freedom Over Fascism.
It's a pleasure to join you.
You know, I have known you now for a really long time, but our listeners may not. So can you introduce yourself to our listeners? Can you tell them what you're up to as an organization and personally?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the legal director of Free Speech for People. That's a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit public advocacy organization. We were founded in 2010 on the day of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, which unleashed unlimited corporate political spending into our nation's elections. And we litigate and advocate on issues that relate to constitutional democracy, including voting rights, campaign finance, and relevant to our topic today, accountability for insurrectionists.
And we're talking today about disqualifying former President Trump from the ballot in various states. Can you tell me more about what the legal basis for that is and where this fight is taking place?
Yeah, so the Constitution has a provision. It's called Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And this provision says that anyone who took an oath to support the Constitution, but then broke that oath and engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the U.S. Constitution, or gave aid and comfort to its enemies, is forever disqualified from any public office unless and until two-thirds of both chambers of Congress vote to remove that disqualification. And this provision of the Constitution hadn't been used for a very long time after the Civil War, because we didn't really have very many insurrections against the U.S. Constitution. And if we had any, we certainly didn't have office holders helping them. But after the January 6, 2021 insurrection, we realized that this provision of the Constitution can be enforced, and it is still a part of the Constitution. It's never been removed, never been repealed. It remains in effect. So Donald Trump is actually disqualified by this provision everywhere in the United States. The issue is, how do you establish that? And in most states, there is a procedure by which you can challenge the constitutional qualifications of a candidate for office, either in state court or sometimes it's before a state elections board. It's different in every state. And so we have brought a series of challenges in multiple states to Trump's candidacy under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
And bring us up to speed. What have the results at this point been where you've brought those challenges?
So we have now five challenges that we've filed. Another organization called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington brought one, and other citizens around the country have brought some in various states. So we have currently three live challenges in Oregon, Illinois, and Massachusetts. The one in Oregon is currently before the state Supreme Court. The ones in Illinois and Massachusetts are going to have hearings later in January. In Colorado, in a case brought by a crew in which we helped out, the Colorado Supreme Court has already decided that Trump is disqualified under Section 3. That was after the trial court held a five-day trial, which both the challengers and Trump were able to present witnesses and evidence and cross-examine each other's witnesses and so forth. And then in Maine, there's another case in which we're helping, where in Maine, the challenge is filed before the Secretary of State, and that's the starting point. And the Secretary of State there, Shannon Bellows, ruled in a very detailed written opinion that Trump is disqualified. He appealed that into the Maine court system, and a decision from the trial court in Maine is expected on the 17th of January.
All right. So that's something to look forward to. So when you've been in court, what kind of arguments are you using? What kind of arguments that people who support removing Donald Trump from the, or using the 14th Amendment, what kind of arguments are they using? And the reverse, what kind of arguments are the Trump people trying to use?
Yeah, so we basically have two things that we need to prove, and then they have a series of arguments that they throw out there to try and explain that Section 3 doesn't apply to Trump or can't be enforced against him. So the two main things that we need to prove are that January 6th was an insurrection, and that Trump engaged in it or gave aid and comfort. So those are two, you know, technically separate issues, but they do tie together. The evidence that January 6th met the legal standard for an insurrection is overwhelming. It was a violent assault on our nation's capital, nearly assassinated the vice president and the Speaker of the House and other congressional leaders. It was the first time that the seat of our nation's government has been taken by force, mm-hmm. certainly since the War of 1812. And it did succeed in obstructing Congress and, for the first time in our nation's history, disrupting the peaceful transfer of power, which is further than the Confederacy ever got. Then the second point that we need to demonstrate is that Trump's involvement constituted engaging. And the term engage, as used in that provision of the Constitution, has been defined by courts as meaning any voluntary effort to assist it. And so the evidence consists of all the things that Trump did to summon the crowd to appear on January 6th for what he described would be a wild day. And then the manner in which he incited the crowd at his speech that day sent them off to the Capitol. And then after they had already broken into it and were attacking it, goaded them on via Twitter in the middle of the insurrection, as well as some other actions that he took and in some cases didn't take during and after. So those are the key elements that we need to prove. And now I can walk through, if you like, all of Trump's arguments, but I want to make clear that I'll describe them, but I want to make clear that, you know, we have opposed all of them and think they're wrong.
Okay. But can I go back and ask you a couple of questions about what this site needs to prove? You describe the insurrection as January 6th, but, and I know this is separate, in Jack Smith's trial, he basically argues that the insurrection was everything that they, that the Trump people did to disturb the peaceful transfer of power, not even including January 6th. Do those pieces of evidence, is that part of the argument, or is it January 6th alone that you have to prove?
Thank you for raising that question. So we have argued, in essence, both. And so the provision says insurrection or rebellion. And although the terms were defined as somewhat overlapping in the, you know, in the mid-19th century when this provision was developed, there is a difference between them in that an insurrection generally needs to be a violent uprising, whereas rebellion doesn't necessarily need to be. If you think about the Civil War, the Southern states seceded before there were actually any shots fired at Fort Sumter. And so they were in rebellion before the insurrection of the that became the Civil War ever began. And so similarly, Trump's efforts that began in late 2020, including the false elector scheme, including his efforts to misuse the Department of Justice, and other efforts to illegally prolong his stay in office beyond the end of his term after he'd lost the election, put together constitute a rebellion. We have focused more of our argument on the aspect of insurrection because there is more precedent for that, and it's easier to demonstrate. Mm-hmm. But it is important to say as well that he engaged in rebellion. And it's also important to say that it's not just his own engagement, but also his aid and comfort to the enemies of the Constitution.
So in the press recently, we've heard a lot of revelations from some of Trump's aides, closest aides in the White House, about his demeanor on the January 6th and his reaction when he found out that Mike Pence was being targeted, you know, basically saying, so what? Is any of that relevant to what you're trying to prove, or is it outside of the scope of what you're doing?
I would say it's relevant, but it's not necessary. The vast majority of the evidence that is necessary to prove the case is already public and has been since January 6th. America saw what happened. Most of what Trump did, he did out in the open, either in public speeches or on Twitter. We saw the insurrection. We've learned more about some of the details of what happened both at the Capitol and with Trump, and we've learned some details of the logistics of what was going on that day, both from the January 6th committee and from subsequent revelations. But the key facts that are necessary to establish that he engaged in insurrection are well settled, have long been public, and there really isn't any factual dispute that's at the heart of the case.
So back to the question of what the other side might choose to argue. Right now we're in the middle of him trying to argue absolute immunity from anything he had ever done as president, which, you know, is a very large claim. On this particular matter, what will his side, or what has his side chosen to argue in their attempt to stay on the ballot?
Trump has made several categories of argument. Some of them will be familiar, maybe things that people have discussed themselves. Others are surprising and probably sound absurd to anyone unburdened by law school. So, you know, the first category of argument is either that January 6th wasn't an insurrection or that his involvement in it didn't consist of engaging in the insurrection. And that's the type of argument that, you know, we expected and is probably some questions that, you know, some Americans have had themselves. And what's helpful in understanding how these play out is to look at history and how those words were used at the time the Constitution was adopted. A lot of people think insurrection has to mean something like the Civil War, with, you know, uniformed columns of men marching in unison like the Confederate Army was. But in fact, there were previous insurrections that were very familiar to 19th century Americans. Depending on your U.S. history classes, many people have learned about what's called Shays' Rebellion, or Shays' Insurrection. That was in Massachusetts, the Whiskey Insurrection, also yes, called the Whiskey Rebellion. And there were others as well that were known as insurrections. And these were much smaller than the Civil War. And the people who wrote and interpreted the 14th Amendment right when it was passed specifically said, this is meant to apply to all those past insurrections as well, not just the Civil War. And those were much smaller than the Civil War, and in some cases about the same size as January 6th, except they didn't involve overtaking the U.S. Capitol and stopping the peaceful transfer of power. So that's the type of argument that I think many people will at least understand what the argument is, even though it's wrong. The arguments that are more bizarre, first of all, Trump says that he never really took an oath to support the Constitution. So remember, under Section 3, it applies to someone who takes an oath to support the Constitution. It doesn't apply to a private citizen. So people who were just ordinary citizens who broke into the Capitol, overtook it after they finished their prison terms, they are eligible to run for office. Section 3 only applies to people who had taken an oath to the Constitution. And that's for a historical reason. The framers of that amendment wanted to focus on the leadership class, not sort of Confederate foot soldiers. But Trump is arguing, and this will sound crazy to most normal Americans, that he never took an oath to support the Constitution. So as I mentioned earlier, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment applies to someone who took an oath to support the Constitution and then broke that oath and engaged in insurrection. It doesn't apply to somebody who was a private citizen. Now, as president, Trump took an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. Those are the words of the presidential oath that are in the Constitution itself. But he's saying that's different from an oath to support the Constitution, and that as a result, he's not considered an officer of the United States who's subject to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. This is kind of crazy. The Constitution uses the words preserve, protect, and defend for the presidential oath, but that is an oath to support the Constitution. The Constitution describes the presidency as an office over two dozen times. And the definition of an officer is someone who holds an office. But those are the types of arguments that Trump is making. He has another category of arguments, which are more about jurisdiction. So he argues that this provision of the 14th Amendment can't be enforced at all unless and until Congress passes a law that enables states to enforce it. Now, what's odd about this is that states enforce the U.S. Constitution all the time. In fact, they are required to do so under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. They decide questions under the 14th Amendment in every state court in all 50 states. It's just that this provision of the 14th Amendment hasn't needed to be applied for a very long time. And then he also argues that states can't decide presidential candidates' qualifications, that only Congress can do this. And there are two things that I want to say about this. One is it's wrong, and none other than Justice Neil Gorsuch has said that states can judge the qualifications of presidential candidates. And that's because we have a system called the Electoral College. That's how we run our elections in the US. It's a system that has a lot of problems, but it is the way that the Constitution sets it up. We don't have a uniform national vote. Instead, each state runs the process for how it chooses its electors, who then vote in the Electoral College. And as part of this, states have control over their ballots. They can't add new qualifications that aren't in the Constitution, but they certainly can enforce the requirements that are in the Constitution. The other crazy thing about this argument is that what Trump is saying is states can't decide whether a candidate is unqualified. What he's saying is that only Congress can decide whether a presidential candidate is ineligible. And the time for Congress to do that would be when Congress counts the electoral votes. That would be January 6th, 2025. So what Trump is saying is that states can't decide this, the US Supreme Court can't decide this, nobody can decide this until after the people have voted, after the Electoral College has voted, and when Congress is counting the votes on January 6th, a date that should ring in infamy as to the last time Trump tried to engage in this type of shenanigans. And I think every sane person would agree that it's better to get this resolved on the earlier side rather than wait until January 6th, 2025.
It seems rather odd that everything that the Trump side argues is in direct contradiction to what the Constitution seems to say in our previous understanding. The argument about original intent was surrounding every issue, and usually it was a conservative judges who are like, oh, well, you know, people, we have to go by what they thought in 1780, blah, blah, blah. And now we know exactly what they were thinking in post-Civil War America, but the original intent seems less interesting to them now. I don't know whether you need to comment on that or if that's just my comment. But
No, I think it's absolutely right. There are a couple of different approaches to use in interpreting the Constitution. The first one is, of course, to look at what the words say. Just look at the text. And anyone can read Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It's written in kind of a crazy roundabout way because...
Really? The Constitution written in a roundabout way?
It says, like, no person can hold any of these office if they have done this thing. And it's a very long and sort of grammatically awkward sentence. But you can read it and you can see that it basically says that no one can hold any office under the United States if they, having taken an oath to support the Constitution, then engaged in insurrection or rebellion. And then there's the words. And of course, you can look up what those words meant in dictionaries at the time. There is the originalism approach, where you look at the sort of original understanding of the people that passed the provision and of the public that ratified it. And there's this idea that the public should be able to understand the Constitution. It's not meant to be some sort of arcane technical document, you know, filled with specialized terms. It's not the tax code. You should be able to look at it. And the people in the 1860s were able to look at it. And so how did they understand it? And these are, you know, maybe not the only ways to understand the Constitution, but they're two very good ways. And there are some on the Supreme Court who have said they think these are the only ways to do it. And if you apply those techniques, the same techniques that they used in cases like Dobbs, the abortion case, and Bruin, the gun rights case, you would clearly see that Section 3 applies to Trump. And so instead, what they need to argue to get around that is to say, well, it can't possibly mean that. It can't possibly mean what it says. You know, think of all the ways in which that could be bad. And in essence, what they're really doing is arguing that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment shouldn't be part of the Constitution. But we already had that debate and we settled it about 150 years ago by putting it into the Constitution.
These arguments seem to be a little awkward, not the case for excluding Trump, but the ways that the arguments have to be twisted around to get around those, what I think are pretty clear statements by the Constitution. What does the legal community think? You know, we've heard from Judge Luttig, we've heard from Lawrence Tribe. What are you hearing from the kind of establishment legal community about these cases and arguments?
Well, I mean, obviously, there are some who, you know, firmly support our position, and then there are those who take Trump's side. But what I think is the most interesting reaction is that there are a lot of people who, when they first heard about this, when we first presented this argument in 2021, had a sort of knee-jerk reaction. That can't be right. You know, without even thinking about it deeply, that can't be right, that will never be accepted, and sort of rejected it without doing any analysis. And then many of these same people, upon looking more closely, you know, what are the meanings of these words? What was the judicial precedent that interpreted this provision of the Constitution in the 1860s? How did the Union Reconstruction government understand this in the 1860s? How did the general public understand it in the 1860s? As they have looked more deeply into the law and the history, they have come to realize that, yes, if you look at the text, the original intent, the original public understanding, the precedent, it all points to Trump being disqualified. I'm not aware of anyone who went in the other direction, who started off agreeing with us, but then on looking at it more deeply, changed their mind and now thinks we're wrong. So what we're seeing is a snowballing momentum as the legal community, to the extent that they look into this, generally come to agree that the case is clear that Trump is disqualified.
All right. Well, that's fascinating. So I would assume that eventually, as all things do, this might get to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes. And in fact, the Supreme Court has already agreed to hear the case that came out of Colorado. And that case is being briefed in January, and there will be an oral argument in February. We don't know how the Supreme Court will decide. It could say that the Colorado Supreme Court got it exactly right. Trump is disqualified. It could find on some, you know, weird legal excuse that Trump can't be ruled as disqualified. It could also rule in a way that addresses the Colorado case, but leaves the matter open for other states to decide. So it's a little hard to predict at this point. And anyone who says that they can predict with 100% confidence what the U.S. Supreme Court is going to do is selling something.
Well, they also have been living under a rock over the last, I don't know, almost decade. So if they think that, there's a lot of big things that are going to get to the Supreme Court this term that will decide some of how we move forward as a country. Is there anything I didn't ask you about the work of showing how Trump should be and is disqualified from running that I didn't ask you?
Well, one thing I think is helpful for a lot of people to think about when the question comes of, you know, how can states just decide this, is to look at a different constitutional qualification for president, which is the 22nd Amendment. The 22nd Amendment says that no president can serve more than two terms. So let's say Barack Obama decides he wants to run for a third term. You can actually imagine this in the right set of circumstances. Let's say, you know, Biden falls or something like that, and, you know, there's an urge for, you know, people to ask Obama to run for a third term because he's still, you know, relatively popular. I think it's clear that he should not be allowed onto any state's ballot because the Constitution says he can't. But all of Trump's arguments that say states can't decide this would mean that Barack Obama has to be allowed onto the state ballot. So if we agree, as I think everyone does, that Barack Obama shouldn't be able to run for a third term because the Constitution says he's ineligible to hold the office, the same applies to Trump. And it's even more of a serious disqualification for someone who actually fomented an insurrection that overtook the U.S. Capitol. In terms of where this is going to go, you know, with the U.S. Supreme Court, it obviously has a 6-3 Republican appointee majority. But one thing I'll say is that of those six, most of them they're all conservative, but they're not necessarily there to carry water personally for Donald J. Trump. And I think that's something that he misunderstood in 2020 when he thought that the Republican majority, including three justices whom he had appointed, would rule for him in all of his lawsuits to try to overturn the 2020 election. And they had zero interest in doing that. And I think that's an important point to remember, is that they are from the conservative legal movement on issues that are about conservative ideology, conservative politics. They obviously have a definite lean. But when it comes to Donald Trump's, you know, personal future, I don't think they're in the tank for him at all. And that's why I think this is a very live issue before the U.S. Supreme Court. And in the meantime, we're pursuing other cases in other states because we don't know how the U.S. Supreme Court will rule or when it will rule. And the deadlines for these challenges are, you know, they're according to timetables that are different in every state. But we don't want to let those deadlines go by without having raised to these challenges. So that's why we're continuing to pursue this. But we do hope that it will be resolved well before the general election in November.
That would be helpful. I think that so many of the cases that are going to come before the Supreme Court, whether they take them or not, so I'm not a lawyer, but I am a historian. They haven't shown any real felicity to precedent, but none of them is stupid. And they can see how what they might decide might influence the future. And that's what I hold as something to be somewhat optimistic about. Or at least not fully pessimistic. Is there anything else people might want to know before I let you go?
Well, I just would encourage people to visit our website. It's freespeechforpeople.org, and you can learn about the work that we do around the country, not only on enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but also on voting rights, campaign finance, fighting against intimidation of voters, and other issues that are so essential to our constitutional democracy in these difficult times.
Thank you for that. And our listeners know that we talk about the freedom to vote and have your vote count being one of the central pieces that we need to be talking about. So the legal piece of that is really super important. So thank you so much for your work. It's so important.
Thank you so much for talking about these issues, Stephanie. It's been great to speak with you again. And I hope that you'll continue to track the work and maybe we'll have a chance for a follow-up.
That would be awesome.
Thank you for listening to Freedom Over Fascism. And thank you to our editor, Benji Wilson. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and please drop us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. We thank you for choosing freedom over fascism.